they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, welcome to another edition of the Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast, folks. This is Raf. Across from me virtually, of course, is James.
Always here, always happy to be here.
You're the perennial guy host. I like that. You're old reliable. You're like old faithful. You're a big geezer. Sorry, geyser. good times. Hey, we have a fun guest that's going to it's joining us this week. I think many of you guys have met this gentleman at some point or watched him talk. He's a staple in our industry. Mr. Rick Howard, sir, welcome.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're
Thanks
good.
For having me on. Appreciate it. Yeah.
We're good. We're glad to have you aboard. We've got a couple of interesting topics to talk through, and then once we once we're done with that, we'll kind of get into you. Who is Rick Howard? By the way, if you try to add Rick Howard on Skype, you have a lot of twins.
I pay them all extra money to spin my spirit into the world.
they take all the PR calls for you.
That's right.
Hey, speaking of that's a good segue into speaking of PR. I don't know if you guys that are listening have noticed this, but a monumental thing just happened. This is sort of like a tectonic plates shifting underneath your feet. Adobe, dun dun dun, is officially announcing the end of life of Flash. So somewhere there's a guillotine that the Flash monster is being dragged to. It's going to take until about 2020, right, James?
Yeah, 2020.
So, you know, tomorrow. In security terms, I think that's like seven decades, but we're officially going to see the end of life for Flash. I honestly never thought I'd live to see the day.
It is surprising. You know, it's one of those things where people have been saying it needs to die for so long and it just never does it. And so it's amazing to see that it's finally somewhat close, I guess. I mean, like 2020 is, you know, a long time in technical terms, but it's really not that far. And, you know, it's good to see it finally go away, I guess. I mean, there's better alternatives, right? I mean, it's not just the security side.
Right? HTML5 has been around for a year or two.
HTML5 replacing it. You know, I mean, there's alternatives to what it can do. So, I mean, if there's faster, better performance ways, you know, it's time for older stuff to move on.
I'm with you on that, but it's a little bittersweet for an old guy like me. Flash has been in my backyard since I've been in the industry. So to see it go away, I'm like, oh, it's kind of like an old friend you'll never see again. So I'm glad to see it go, but I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, Rick, don't get too excited. I'm not sure it's an old friend you'll never see again, because this is going to be like Windows NT4. It'll be around until we're old and gray. It's just that Adobe's not going to support it anymore.
I don't know. You know, it says on here, though, there at the very end of the article, it says that Microsoft said that Flash will be removed from Windows entirely by the end of 2020. So
yeah, sure. Just like we removed NT4 entirely at the end of the first cycle. And then there was like this, no, seriously, stop paying us. We don't want to support it cycle. And there was like the third one, which is like, no, seriously, we're not going to take your money anymore. So please stop asking.
Well, you know, and it is 2020. So they may be saying, you know, Windows 13 or something won't have it, but everybody still running Windows XP will.
Right. Oh, that's depressing. Hey, Rick, I don't know if you remember. Do you guys remember Newgrounds.com when that was a big thing? Everybody, you know, that was the birth of like the cool place of Flash, all the cool Flash games.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? I know it well, sir.
Yeah, that was I don't know. So let's find out. Let's find out what happens when Flash goes away.
What'll be interesting, I think, with the demise of Flash here is that unlike you know, operating systems that can surface out there for a long time. You know, there's a lot of other actors that control what you're doing with these things. You know, so if I have Flash or there's a Flash site or something, but I have the browsers are going to start blocking that. Right? I mean, you know, I mean, the browsers are quick with HTTPS now, and we're making lots of movement there. So if you've got Chrome and Firefox and Safari and all these working and they say, hey, look, at 2020, boom, we are not loading Flash. I don't care what you do. It's done. You've removed a lot of attack vector there, you know, if they won't load it. So
that's true.
Unlike an operating system, I can keep running. You know, I've got other means that say, you know what? Yeah, you can surf with my browser, but the browser is not going to support. So you can have Flash on your machine, but it's not going to do anything. You know, I mean, that it greatly reduces the attack surface if that's how you're attacking it. I mean, I don't see people attacking Flash, you know, during these contests through the network. They're attacking it through a browser, right?
Right. That's true. That's true.
So if the browsers really step up and knock that out, and, you know, people have to pretty much stay updated on browsers or you can't view anything, you know, we might have better luck seeing this thing actually disappear quicker than you know, all these other things that end of life and are still around.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I get kids in college and high school and all the homegrown Flash sites that explain the lesson of the day and how they transfer those over to new formats. I don't think that's ever going to get done. So it'll be this giant scream by all the academians in the world when Flash is officially gone, I think.
Well, do we have another Y2K issue? I mean, is there going to be all of a sudden a huge requirement for you know, people to be able to do HTML5 to convert everything from Flash to HTML5 or some other format?
Yeah, there's going to be a huge consulting effort to get all that fixed in time. I doubt it, but I can see it. I can see it now.
Man, that's
it's
not
possible.
Ricky, you brought back something because there's a lot of our community association is built upon some very, very old versions of Flash, and I thank God I don't have to put anything sensitive into that thing. But I can't just imagine the development effort that's going to be required for all these apps that have been out there for years that had absolutely no desire to update their applications except for, well, you know, the end is nigh. I mean, two and a half years.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet many of those sites don't know that they're even affected. You know, they just put something on their personal web page and everybody started using it and they may even walked away. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at the end.
Yeah, that's gonna be a trip, guaranteed. Well, James, what's the next one? Because this one's also interesting.
Yeah, so I just saw this. You know, apparently there was some targeted attacks on some Chrome extension developers. One of them being the Common Web Developer extension used by lots of people. This guy that develops this extension actually was pretty candid about what happened. He actually wrote a blog post about it, talking about it. And, you know, basically what happened is, you know, somebody sent him an email saying that, you know, he had to update his account, his extension account. And, you know, busy with work, whatever. This is a good example of this can happen to anybody. He clicked the link. He entered his credentials. And the next morning, you know, he was getting tweets saying that somebody had uploaded a new version of the developer extension that was serving up ads. So apparently it only affected it for about 3 hours was the time window. You know, but lesson learned here from his side was, you know, hey, look, I mean, I don't know what happened, right? I mean, I'll admit it. I clicked the link. I put in my credentials. I didn't have two-factor enabled. You know, so now he does have two-factor enabled. You know, he changed his password, everything. You know, but, you know, this is one of those things. I mean, people often don't consider this until it happens to them. And, you know, we talk about social engineering. Look, we can social engineer anybody. So, you know, this could happen anywhere. But to think of the reach that this had, I mean, only for 3 hours, I don't know how many people had actually loaded this extension. But, you know, I mean, you're looking at stuff that a lot of these extensions, some of them auto-update. So you're just sitting there in your browser and all of a sudden, boom, somebody takes over that account. And what's interesting is There was another extension that had the same thing happen to it very recently, which somebody made the assumption that it was maybe a test run for this one because it was a much bigger audience. But it was another one called Copyfish, which only has about 30,000 installs, that also had this similar attack come at it. So kind of interesting to see. You know, I mean, we've seen this before where people go after things like Node Package Manager or, you know, something like that where, hey, look, can I update somebody's packages and people just download them and trust that they're theirs. You know, there's risks to this stuff that we add into our browser.
Yeah, look at how many extensions. I think the days when many of us adding extension after extension after extension are gone. But, you know, I remember the OWASP slides from a talk I gave years ago that had like, you know, some picture of somebody's browser with like 12 browser helper objects, right, and plugins into IE, and you know, 17 toolbars, which basically made the browser unusable. But I think it's interesting to note sort of where we are now and how some of the, like, Chrome hides some of this stuff in. It does a fairly decent job. Firefox is, well, it's Firefox. You know, IE and everybody else has got plugins. But the fact that we still have, you know, we're still dependent largely upon visual trust of something.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it came from the trusted account. You know, I mean, there's nothing an end user would have been able to see that, you know, to know that it wasn't it. It's not like they went to another site and downloaded the fake web developer app. You know, it came from, you know, the store, right? It came from the extension manager, whatever it is, that downloads those. I mean, it came from a trusted source. But, you know, it's one of those things where we have to be conscious that the more these things we use, obviously the more risk is there. And, you know, these extensions have a lot of capability. You know, you load one of these into your browser, I mean, they can see a lot of stuff, access a lot of things. You know, so a lot of that stuff we try to build in to help protect our apps kind of goes away when you get an extension put in there that has much more rights than we would hope for.
Yeah. Rick, how many browser extensions do you have in your browser?
I probably have, I don't know, 5 or 6 that I use regularly. How about you?
Which browser? I've got nothing. I see. My my Firefox has 1, 2, 3, 3. Because other than that, Firefox will just collapse. And I know I'm picking on Firefox. I always have. It's not going to change. I've got like only a couple in Chrome. One of them, of course, being WebEx, like everybody else has, which probably has compromised me several times. But you know. I'm on a Mac, so I don't have an IE, thank God. But a couple on Safari. Not too bad. Not too bad. I'm 4.
I'm rocking a whopping 3 in Firefox, which would be Cookie Manager, Foxy Proxy, and Tampa Monkey.
There you go.
I don't, and those are for testing purposes. I don't use any other extensions. I bet I'm not checking Chrome right now, but I bet I don't have any loaded in Chrome.
Well,
not an extension person, I guess.
I'm a Chrome guy. I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So,
well, that's not. I mean, that's again. But how do you get to that point where you're like, all right, I'm going to install this. Remember that thing that they got sent around recently? That nabbed a bunch of people to Google Docs fake that went around for a bit. You guys remember that?
Yeah.
The copies are getting so good. It's getting hard to tell them from the real ones.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. When it comes to things like social engineering, I mean, there's no way to get rid of that vector, right? I mean, gone are the days, really. I mean, you can still do it for a lot of them. But, you know, this whole, oh, look at the grammar. Look at this. Look at these key elements. You know, I mean, I'll tell you, when I do phishing for clients, I don't put any of that stuff in there. Right, I mean, because it's not realistic. That's not how the phishing attack, the good ones are going to be. They're going to have good grammar. They're going to have all this stuff. You know, there's other indicators that people need to think about and look at. But, you know, it's a good example of somebody just in everyday, you're not thinking that aspect. You know, it looks like an email, I guess, from Google, you know, where it says, hey, you just got to update something in your account. Go click here to sign in. I guess his account doesn't stay signed in very often, so he's got to sign. It, you know, it's normal. It's normal for him to have to sign in and do those things. And I mean, I could see anybody falling for that at some point, right? Given on what's going on in your daily business.
Yeah. Ah, boy, you know, Rick, this certainly makes your job as a chief executive not super easy, right?
Well, it's fun to I'm the chief security officer at Palo Alto Networks, and it's an interesting job from anything else I've ever done because it's a security company, and you're trying to help secure the company, and everybody has an opinion, okay? In normal companies, there's only the security staff that you have to worry about. But now, you know, half the company are security engineers, and they've all been there and done that. So it's been an interesting experience.
You know, so do you do internal product security as well, or are you the external?
I own Unit 42, which is the Palo Alto Networks threat intelligence group.
Okay. So you guys are probably targeted as much as anybody. I mean, security analysts are being targeted. Anybody in a security company, you know, I work my day job as a security company. James is in security. We're definitely targeted, right? I mean, it's just how we're targeted more than the average users.
Well, there's some circumstantial evidence about that, you know, because we all go on shows like this and speak out in public. So when bad guys try to find targets, those are the first ones on their radar.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's always going to be interesting to be on the defense, especially when you guys provide the security infrastructure for so much of the internet. You know, I can only imagine how many attackers, bad guys, want at that, the source code, the plans, to try to find holes that they can exploit. I don't envy that position.
Well, on the plus side though, we have 40,000 customers these days, right? And all of those, firewalls deployed, in those customer organizations are collecting intelligence on how bad guys are doing things.
Yeah.
So from where we were 10 years ago, we have a rich source of intelligence to see what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine so. So what kind of fun things are you working on now? What's sucking up all your time?
I don't know if it's sucking up all my time, but I do have a hobby horse that I've been palling around for a couple of years. It's called the Cybersecurity Canon Project. Have you guys heard of this before?
We have. I have.
I have not.
So here's how it started, right? I have to back up a little bit in my history. What I love about this job is that there's always something new to learn. There's always something exciting. It's like, oh, man, I didn't even know you could do that kind of thing. And so there's always some sort of wonder out there that is part of our job. I really, really like that. You know what I hate about the job? There's always something new out there. There's always something I got to learn. Okay. And then so I'm never, ever caught up. And what happens by most of us is that we read everything we can get our hands on. And like you guys, I'm sure you got a stack of books down in your basement. You know, I have a big shelf down there of cybersecurity books that I've read, books I promised myself I'm going to read, books I've claimed I've read when I'm in a certain peer group, right? And so I was down there about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was looking through the pile, and I pulled out one of the books off the shelf, knowing that I had read that book because I remember the cover. I even had the author sign it for me, okay, but I couldn't remember a damn thing that was in that book, right? So as a personal project to myself, I started rereading some of the more important books, and so that I remember what I read, I wrote book reviews for some of them, and I got about 25 of them together and went to the RSA conference, this is about 4 years ago now, and presented on here's 25 books that we all should have read by now. And so it was well received. And then Palo Alto Networks decided to sponsor it. So here's what we did. We created like a rock and roll hall of fame for cybersecurity books. We have a committee of 15 practitioners. These are outside CISOs, journalists, lawyers, hackers, anybody that's interested in these kinds of things. And they review the books. and decide which ones get put on the candidate list. And then every year we put two or three into the Hall of Fame. So we've been doing it now for 4 years. And we have a big Hall of Fame ceremony where we fly the authors out and we give like an, I wear a tux and have big trophies like the Academy Awards, and the authors make speeches, and it's a lot of fun. Okay. And so today we have about 35 books on the candidate list, and we put about 15 into the Hall of Fame since we started. So here's my question to you guys. Do you have a favorite cybersecurity book that you would recommend to the Cannon Project?
Ooh, I've got a couple. Let's see. Which one would I recommend, though?
Remember, before you recommend this, you have to recommend books that you think everybody should have read by now, or they have a hole in their education, right? That's the first criteria. And the second one is they have to be evergreen, okay? They can't go out of date.
So I think the one that comes to mind the most is Howard Schmidt's Patrolling Cyberspace. I've got that book autographed by him and sitting at the top of my shelf. It's a really good read.
So that one, no one has reviewed yet. So I'm going to reach out to you to see if you would do that for us. Okay, yeah, maybe you'll put that one out. Because anybody, listen, you can't get on the candidate list unless somebody writes a review making the case. This isn't just a book list. This, someone put some blood and sweat into making the case that everybody should read it. So I'll be looking for that book review from you on that particular book.
Damn it, this is like school. I just got an assignment for speaking up.
Yeah, good job for speaking up, Raph.
So, James, what would you recommend?
Oh, man, you know, the book I would recommend is already on the list. I saw it and...
Oh, you cheater.
No, it's interesting. I did skim the list really quick, actually, but I don't know. Like, looking at my bookshelf right now, which is not in the basement because I live in Florida and we don't have basements, you know, looking at the bookshelf, probably something that would probably be timeless is maybe like the threat modeling book from Adam Shostak. But, yeah. I mean, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I agree with kind of your first statement, a portion of it. I have a bunch of books on the wall. Some of them I told myself I'd read. And then other ones I say, yeah, I've read those. Yeah. But that's what I'm not a big reader. So
I'll tell you that we're all busy people, right? And if you go to Amazon and just look up cybersecurity books, you'll get a list of 1,500 books.
Right.
So if you decide you're going to make time to read a book, how do you decide, right? And so what the Cannon Project is a curation of books you should have on your radar.
I bet you I can name at least one that's on there without even looking at it. Gene Kim's book, I bet, is on there, The Phoenix Project.
It is absolutely on there. It's one of my favorite books of last year, only because I think that all of us, cybersecurity defenders, network defenders, practitioners, should be thinking about DevOps. And what's interesting about that book, if you guys aren't familiar, is these guys wrote a novel about DevOps because they knew that nobody was going to read a nonfiction book about the subject, right? And they wanted a broader audience. So, and they wrote a very interesting story about how DevOps saved an online retailer. And I highly recommend it. If you have any interest in DevOps, that's the book you should be reading.
Yeah, this is the book that I just told an audience yesterday. This is a book that you're going to read and know every character because you work with them.
That's true. It's true.
Absolutely, no doubt. Gene's those guys are just the guys that read it or that wrote it rather are masterful storytellers in their own right. But it was pretty darn amazing reading that book, and I was like, wow, that's kind of crazy that you know I've worked with all those people. I know that CIO. I know that VP of Ops. I know that networking guy. I'm like, holy crap. Yeah, if you haven't read Phoenix Project, you guys, go out and read it. This is go do that right now. Like, pause the show, go read Phoenix Project, and come back. It is that fast of a read, though, isn't it?
Yeah, you can read it in the afternoon. It's a real small book, but it's fabulous, right? And I'll tell you what, I'm reading one right now that'll make it onto the candidate list this year. That's going to be a companion book to that, I believe, because Gene's book on DevOps is kind of a philosophy of what DevOps is and what it could do for you. But if you want a how-to manual to get it done, I'm going to recommend a book here that hasn't made it there yet, but I'm about done writing the review. It's called Systems Reliability Engineering, written by most of the Google engineers.
Okay.
Right. And these guys have been doing this kind of automation since around 2004, you know, about 6-7 years before DevOps was even a thing. Right. So if DevOps is a philosophy, SRE, Systems Reliability Engineering, is an how-to document on how you would do it if you wanted to do it for real.
That's pretty impressive, man. So the Canon thing, is that how much activity you guys get on that? I mean, is that something that how many people would you say have participated in that in terms of like get sit down and read some of that?
You know, everywhere I go, people have their favorite book. I wouldn't say everybody's jumping out and reading everyone on the Canon. Right. Everywhere I go and I talk about, they all recommend books they think should be there. We eventually get them on the list because the committee reviews them and puts them on. But we get a regular, a good volume of people to the website every day looking at those books. And here's the thing you can use it for. All right. You can point your newbie security people at it if they want to start trying to figure out what the security thing is. You can point your bosses to it. If they don't really have a clue about what cybersecurity is, they could start there. And then you can point, if you're looking to hone your skills on something you don't know anything about, that would be the first place I would look for reading material. So it's a little something for everybody.
Is there a way that it breaks it down to give you an idea of, hey, you should start here? I mean, because I see on here, like being able to sort by occupation, you know, setting up like aspiring InfoSec practitioners, technical, but then there, you know, I mean, there's 15 books listed on there. So is there a way to rank those or have people help rank those to say, hey, you should really start with this one to get your feet wet and it'll kind of build upon that from here? Or does it really matter?
No, I think it does. And you're absolutely right. The committee is working on that right now to have better filter for those kinds of things. Because you're right, it's a little daunting to say, oh, I'm interested in this subject and here's 15 books you should read.
Right. So,
that's a good comment. We're working on that now. If you have any ideas of how we should sort it, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Welcome to InfoSec. Here's 150 books you need to get done before you get going.
Yeah, exactly. Do you guys have a gateway book, the one that got you into security or a gateway movie or something like that?
Mine is probably Sneakers. I love that movie. I mean, I liked Hackers, but it was, you know, even back then it was slightly unrealistic. But I like Sneakers, and I think for me it wasn't a book that got me into it, but it was, you know, manuals that got me into it. I started reading, you know, Linux books, and I was like, this is pretty interesting. Let's try this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I don't know, I guess probably Hackers was probably the first, you know, exposure to it. I don't think there's any book. I mean, I started off as a developer and, you know, then moved into security. So a lot of it was just, you know, seeing stuff online and, you know, starting to get interested in it. So it was more just kind of falling into it, just getting into the right areas, I guess.
For me, the movie was War Games with Matthew Broderick, okay? And that's got me interested in it. But the book that got me into it was Clifford Stoll's The Cuckoo's Egg.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good one.
So I love this book, right? Because the stuff that, and this is an old book, right? It happened in the mid 80s, right? And it was it's the story of the first public cyber espionage attack orchestrated by the Russians using East German hacker mercenaries to break into the U.S. university systems that were automatically connected to the government systems, because back then there wasn't any security. The internet was just strings and cans, right?
Isn't that what that is today?
Yeah, no, we got the string is longer. Okay.
Right. Now we got twisted pair strings.
Nice.
Yeah. So the author's Clifford, right? And he's an astronomer by trade and he's working at Berkeley, you know, and Clifford is a, how do I describe him? You know, there's, in the political spectrum, there's the right, there's the center, there's the left, there's Berkeley left, and then there's Clifford. He's way over there on the far left side of the political spectrum. He doesn't like anything to do with the government. He doesn't want to talk to the man. He, you know, and he makes his own clothes. He gardens his own food. I mean, you know, he's that guy. He kind of looks like Doc Brown from Back to the Future. Okay,
kind of. Like. Kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And so, but Berkeley is laying off their astronomers when this book starts, right? And but everybody likes Cliff. He's funny. He's a happy-go-lucky guy. So the IT department says, Cliff, come over to us. Run this Unix lab for us and wait for your job to come open. In the meantime, you'll have a job and you'll have something to do. Oh, and by the way, there is an error in the student computer accounting program. You know, back in those days, we made students pay for computer time on the mainframes. And every month, the entire student body at Berkeley, it was off by 50 cents. And nobody could figure out what the problem was. So they said, Cliff, come run this Unix lab for us. Go figure out this error. You'll be a hero to us, and you can go get your job when it comes open in a year or so. So that's what he does. That 45-cent accounting error was the first evidence of those Russian attacks. All right. So now the book walks you through 2 years of his investigation of trying to prove what was going on. And here's this guy, the far left, doesn't ever want to talk to the man, but he's on a phone call every day with the NSA, the FBI, and the CIA trying to track these bad guys down. It's fabulous, right? And, you know, you can give it to your mom because it reads like a Jason Bourne novel, right? There's a love story in it. There's even a chocolate chip cookie recipe in it that that I've tried. So that's the book that got me into cybersecurity.
For the chocolate chip cookies, of course.
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, that's a good one. I like that story. It's a good reason. Hey, folks, if you haven't tried giving it a shot, how do they find that the cybersecurity canon besides Google, Rick?
Yeah, I would just go to look up in Google, look up canon as canon of literature, not canon you blow stuff up. And Palo Alto Networks, you'll get to the website and you'll see what it looks like.
Cool. So what else are you working on, man? That's kind of fun. That's a good side project. It'll keep you busy.
Yeah, I can't believe they pay me money to do that. I love this little hobby, and Palo Alto Networks has been a big sponsor of it, so I'm really proud of that. For more serious matters, have you guys heard about the Cyber Threat Alliance?
That's not one I'm familiar with. I've heard about it. I know people. You've talked about it previously. Tell us a little more.
So there have been information sharing organizations, official information sharing organizations, since the late 1990s. That's when all the ISACs got started. And ISAC stand for Information Sharing and Analysis Centers. It started when President Clinton signed the Presidential Decision Directive saying, you know, all you critical infrastructure companies, you should share intelligence with each other. And he didn't give them any money and he didn't give them any resources, but, you know, you should do it because of national security.
That sounds like every security CISO ever. We're not going to give you any money. We're not going to really give you any resources, but you have a really important job. Don't screw it up.
Yeah, so go off and do things, right? The ISAC, and there was like 15 of them when they first started, and the ISAC that emerged as the leader is the financial sector ISAC, because that community threw a lot of money at it and threw a lot of really smart people at it, and they are widely recognized as probably the most organized information sharing group that's out there as an ISAC. But even those guys, and they're really good, they have two big problems, right? You know, one is they don't have any way to automatically cross the last mile. Okay, and what I mean by that is there's over 500 members in the FSISAC, and all of them receive the intelligence reports, but somebody on the other end has to receive the intelligence, decide that it's important to their network, decide what to do about it, and then they have to implement that decision. For most of those smaller banks, those community banks, all right, you know, they got two guys and the dog in the back room, and they're doing the firewall, they're doing the printer, and they're making coffee. They have no time, okay, to read intelligence reports and implement any of that stuff. So I call that automatically crossing the last mile, and most network defenders have no way to do that. The interesting thing, though, is that security vendors like Palo Alto Networks and other members of the Cyber Threat Alliance, we have ways to automatically update our products whenever we discover something new. I told you I run the Unit 42 group, the threat intelligence group of Palo Alto Networks. When they discover some new indicator of compromise, we can convert that into multiple prevention controls down the kill chain, deliver it to 40,000 customers around the world in about 5 minutes, right? That's an amazing capability. Most security vendors have something similar like that. So what we've decided to do is join forces and make sure that all of us have the same intelligence so that we can blanket the world with prevention controls so that our customers, our collective customers, don't have to do that, right? And so the Cyber Threat Alliance formed into a nonprofit at RSA this past year. We have six founding members, and I got to make sure I get them all right. Okay, it's Palo Alto Networks, it's Checkpoint, Cisco, Fortinet, McAfee, and Symantec are the founding members. And then we have some seven or eight affiliate members who are also in the club sharing information. And what they share is not just indicators of compromise. What we are sharing as a group of vendors is adversary playbooks. We want to make sure that we know everything that there is to know about specific adversaries, not that they're Russian or German or whatever, okay? I don't care to attribute who they are, but I want to know that adversary X does this when they deliver stuff, does this when they compromise an endpoint, does this thing when they do command and control, does this when they go lateral. I want to have the entire set so that when I put my blocks in place, I am putting multiple blocks in all of my prevention controls I have deployed for a specific adversary. So let me ask you guys this. I ask this wherever I go. How many playbooks do you think there are? And I'm not talking about attack. There's a gazillion attacks. But when the adversary comes to work in the morning, gets his cup of coffee, sits down in his terminal and decides he's going to attack some new victim, he pulls his notebook off the shelf and says, step one, do this. Step two, do that. How many notebooks are there?
I'd say probably, what, five?
Yeah, I wouldn't go much higher than that, to be honest. I mean, I was thinking like one or two.
And I will tell you that it depends on how you define what a playbook is, right? I will tell you that I've talked to a lot of different countries' cyber intelligence shops. I've talked to the U.S., U.K., Japan, Australia, Singapore. They think the number is small, like you, like less than 100, okay? If you talk to people that don't have clearances, they think it's bigger, like 10,000 to 20,000.
Oh, come on.
I know, but I'm with you. It's probably smaller. But here's the point. It's not big, right? This is the problem we can get our hands around. Right. The idea is that we want to share everything we know about let's say, 100 playbooks that are known and get the protections in place. We could really change the game. And that's what the Cyber Threat Alliance is trying to do. The second thing that it does is we looked at what the ISACs do. What happens in all the ISACs is not everybody shares.
Right.
If you look at the FS-ISAC, just the big guys do, like Citibank and Bank of America.
That's the challenge. We've been struggling with this, and I say weeks. I've been working with companies that do this. The hardest part of any of those threat sharing networks is everybody wants to consume, nobody wants to contribute. Or sometimes it's not even for lack of wanting. It's lack of knowing what to contribute, how to contribute it, being able to have the resources to contribute it, and then having your legal team allow you to do so.
Yeah, yeah. And so we recognize that as a major problem. So as a mandate in the Cyber Threat Alliance, you have to share or you can't be in the club. And there's a minimum standard. When we first started it a couple of years ago, it was 1,000 pieces of malicious code a day. And we measured it, and I got an email alert in my inbox every day. You know, Palo Alto Networks didn't meet the threshold, you know, for today. Phone calls were made. We'd yell at each other and fix it for the next day, you know, because we're all, you know, competitors. We don't really like each other that much, right? but we made it a mandate that you had to share. Since we've gone public as a nonprofit, we've upgraded the sharing platform to share adversary playbooks. So it's no longer counting malicious code. They get points for every artifact that they add to a playbook. All right. And so right now the minimum point is 10,000. So anybody in the alliance has to get to a minimum of 10,000 points every day or they can't be in the club.
That's kind of cool. I mean, look, the reason I said five is because most of this stuff is either, you know, send email with Trojan, send email with fake link or with a reasonably good link, use old exploit against, you know, something that was patched 5 years ago. And somewhere maybe in that at the bottom of that is use a 0-day. But I'm pretty sure that's fairly rare given how much your companies like yours and others tell us that it's rare to see 0 days. So that's why I say it's, I don't see all that many. I don't think there's that many playbooks based on what I've seen.
Well, I would say that I agree with you when you it's that generic, but each adversary has a very specific way they do each of those things, right?
Okay, fair point. Okay.
Yeah, so that's signature for them, right? And signature is not the right word because everybody hates signature, but I just mean that adversary X has very specific things they do all the way down the kill chain, and we can attribute that as a set of things that they have in their playbook. Yeah, and we want to specifically block each of those things.
Yeah, it's a set of attributes that's essentially their TTPs for the way they will go after a target, and that makes sense.
Yeah, and we're kind of trying to change the industry thinking on this, right? Because typically people share artifacts. You know, they'll share a piece of mail code or an IP address with very little context. What we are trying to do here is saying the adversary is the problem, not the artifacts. So let's find everything that we can possibly think of that can prevent them from getting into our network and share it with everybody, okay? So that, and in this case, it's all the vendors, because we already have an automatic way to put those in place. So if you have one or multiple of us in your networks, you're going to receive those automatically, and you don't have to think about it to protect your networks.
So are people participating in this even though they're not members? I mean, the way I'm envisioning this is, you know, you have the members, and I'm looking at the site right now where it lists the founding and the affiliate, you know, most of them security vendors, you know, that then push this stuff all down to the clients, right? So even though, you know, a small little community bank isn't a participating member of a cyber threat alliance, they kind of are, right? Because, I mean, they're receiving this stuff. They don't have to be members to be the consumers of this information, correct?
Correct. They do not have to, right? This is this trend in the industry that many people are calling automatic orchestration. Network defenders are tired of having to integrate all the vendor products, right? And so they're asking vendors to do it for them. This is one example of that. So that, you're right, you don't have to be a member of the Cyber Threat Alliance to benefit from your vendor being part of the vendor alliance.
So does that take away, though, like when you talk about the ISAC and you look at things like really the only people that are contributing are the big people, like a Bank of America or Citibank or something, but are they ones that would be joining something like this? Or, and if not, are you now losing that insight because this is really more of a security vendor space because of the contributions?
Yeah, we don't think that other ISACs will join, but what we're building at this very moment is ways for them to send us stuff if they think it's important, okay? So kind of a one-way in, and they don't have to pay to be a member of the alliance either, but if the FS-ISAC sees something, you know, because all these ISACs have very, very unique intelligence, right? Based on their industry, right? So all the vendors are in all of those places, but the ISACs get to know a lot of very specific stuff. If they discover something, if the financial sector ISAC says, oh, we got to make sure the vendors have this so we can blanket it around the world in minutes, we need a way for them to send it in, and we're working on that right now.
You know, I got to tell you, I'm relatively excited about the fact that this thing exists, and I applaud the fact that you've got a bunch of vendors that otherwise compete providing data into this space. Because after all, how you do your magic is different than, you know, that's your secret sauce, but protecting, sharing this and protecting your consumers is ultimately better for everybody. Whether one company does it with one technology, another does it with another technology, that's, you know, that's part of that secret sauce you have. But I think I think that this is a very interesting effort, because when, as you were saying, sharing how somebody launches an attack or goes after their adversaries or goes after their victims, rather, how you do that is extremely important. Because it helps give you some, what's the word I'm looking for here? It helps give you a thing that doesn't change every day, that doesn't change twice a day, right? So you're not looking at IP addresses, IOCs. You're looking at things that are fairly static in the way organizations behave.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. That's part of our philosophy. We know that adversaries change their playbook, but they do not wholesale throw a playbook out and start something new every day. They're keeping the most of it the same and trying something new, you know, maybe in the delivery phase or the compromise phase or some other phase. So the idea then, if you have all those blocks already in place, even if they try something new in one spot, they're still going to be blocked in all the others. And the other thing you said I want to hit on, too, because that's part of the philosophy of the Alliance, too. We all the members agree that we are not going to compete on intelligence anymore. We mostly have the same intelligence anyway for this kind of thing. What we're going to do is share the intelligence with everybody and then compete on product instead. And that's a really different development in the industry.
That's kind of cool, man. That's really it's actually really exciting. Glad you guys are doing that. Do you see momentum in that? Are you looking at more of your vendors / competitors going, hey, I want in on this?
Absolutely. And we hired Michael Daniel to be the president of the company. If you've never heard of him, he was President Obama's former cyber czar. And he has two tasks to get done this year. We want at least 25 members in the Cyber Threat Alliance by the end of the calendar year. And he has to show value back to the community. Right. And so for the first one, I got an ask for you and your listeners. When they talk to vendors out there, this is what I tell everybody. Be nice, be polite, listen to their pitch, even buy their stuff. But as they go out the door, ask them why they're not a member of the Cyber Threat Alliance. Okay, and watch them stumble through that answer. And then point them to me, right? Because they have to be here, right? And if I could be even bolder, if they are doing RFPs, make them answer why they don't think they should be part of the Cyber Threat Alliance, all right? And make them put that in writing. And that'll push vendors into the alliance, and that's where we need them.
That's a great place to effect change is with the wallet and RFPs and stuff like that. I remember, I worked for a vendor. I remember, working for a manufacturer for years, and the way that we would figure out what in the heck our customers wanted was what was in the RFPs.
Yep. So, and I guess the other question I always get is, if you look at some of the vendors that are listed on the website, some of those sell cyber threat intelligence, right? Which we encourage them to do. The vendors don't have to give us all their intelligence. They just have to meet a minimum bar, right? And so Symantec has a commercial intelligence service and others in there, okay? But they are perfectly happy to be part of the alliance and helping the community get better.
Well, that is an awesome place to end this, because we could talk about this for an hour, but it's been 50. So, well, Rick, thanks for joining us, man. This has been fun.
Thanks for letting me come on, guys. I really appreciate it. It has been fun.
For those of you guys that don't know, we've been trying to get Rick on this show for, a year?
Since two Black Hats ago. Okay, yeah. So,
good God. Yeah. Well, it finally happened. You were on. Hopefully this was fun for you as well. And I know we learned a ton. I'm going to go skim some books in the Security Canon. I've got some homework you're going to make me write about patrolling cyberspace.
Yes, I am.
And then, the Cyber Threat Alliance, that's a good thing to get people, get buyers. Hey, if you guys are a buyer out there, you're influencing the buying cycle and you're buying security tech and your vendor isn't part of the Cyber Threat Alliance, there may be a good question of, so why the hell not?
Well said, sir. Well said.
All right. Well, cool. James, thanks for playing along, bud.
Always happy to be here. Very interesting conversation. I enjoy these.
I always learn something new. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate you taking the time, and we will talk to you guys later. Thanks for listening, for James and myself and Mr. Rick Howard. Thank you for being on Down the Secure Rabbit Hole podcast, and you all out there, thanks for listening. We'll catch you another time, another place, on another Down the Secure Rabbit Hole podcast. Fade to song. Bye.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, Michael, and our guests, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.